This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
Let's talk.
John Brown. There are times where I feel like a child on Christmas morning. Trust me on this one. Because if you were listening a couple of weeks ago, I had an interview with a man who has since been described by you, my dear listeners, as my even more manic twin. And we had such a laugh last time talking about, amongst other things, elephants in armour, flaming Campbells, and the world's first battlefield mobile barbecue. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and whatever else is listening to today, we had such fun last time that I decided to get him back. I begged, I borrowed, I screamed, because I want to talk about his previous book, which is called, and I'm going to get the pronunciation all wrong with this one because I'm just good like that. The book is called, what's it called, Jem, again?
Deus Vult, A Concise History of the Crusades.
Yes, indeed. Jem, how are you, my friend?
I'm delirious to be back.
Right then. So, ladies and gentlemen, get on your chain mail anoraks, unravel them, put them on, because we're going to do the Crusades in 28 minutes. One, two, three.
No pressure.
So, Crusade. Let's start with a basic one, shall we? Because, I mean, let's talk. If you say Crusades, people are thinking Richard Lionheart, guys in wearing sort of England tops, if you like. Like the Cross of St. George and all that, against the Muslim hordes, which is Saladin and, you know, curved sabers and all that. And it's all a Christian v. Islam bash up in the Middle East. Shoot that one down, if you would please, Jem.
Absolutely. More than happy to do that. So the idea behind all of this is the concept of the just war. And in the book, while I spend most of my time talking about the Crusades, I actually take the first chapter, starting off with Jesus. I mean, if you read the New Testament, it's very clear, it's pacifistic. Thou shalt not kill in the Old Testament, and then you get turn the other cheek in the New Testament. So how do you go from that to literally killing in the name of God by the end of the 11th century? And so what I sort of take people on a theological and philosophical journey in the first chapter. It's more interesting than it sounds. A lot more people die than you might think with that.
Right.
Pointing out that the first thing that has to happen is, well, it's very easy to be pacifistic when you're a bunch of priests and religious people living in small communities. But the moment the Roman Empire becomes a Christian state, now you've got an army, and armies do have to defend areas. So it's really, that's the starting point of the conversation. Then fast forwarding, we get people like St. Augustine, not the famous one, but a guy called St. Augustine of Hippo in the 400s. He starts saying, well, you know, you have the right to defend what you want as a state. And then in the 600s, we get a Byzantine emperor, a guy called Heraclius, and he basically carries out the First Crusade. He gets the church to sanction his war, to recapture Jerusalem. But he's not fighting against Muslims, because Islam hasn't been invented yet. He's off into what we would now say modern-day Iraq and Iran to fight against, in essence, the Persians, who had taken over Jerusalem. So he uses the church's backing, the church's right to raise taxes. He is fighting for God. He reclaims Jerusalem. That's in the 600s, and it just keeps growing. If you think about Europe in the first millennium, it's under attack by the Vikings, and as I said in the last episode about the devil's horsemen, things like the Huns and the Magyars. So there are all these pagan people attacking all the Christians of Europe. Why shouldn't they defend themselves? And so we get to the very end, into the 1090s, and we get Pope Urban II.
What a name. Why don't we have popes called Urban anymore? That's what I want to know. I mean,
my favorite one is to link to the Crusades is Pope Innocent III. It doesn't sound nicer than that, but Pope Innocent III declares more more crusades than anybody else, including a couple that are considered war crimes, even at the time. Mm. So, you know, not so innocent. But you now get this idea, starting in the 1090s, that affects the whole of Europe. And the point that I make in the book is you cannot understand European history, whether you like this stuff or anti this stuff, you can't understand European history and culture without the Crusades. It's not a unique event like the Battle of Hastings. Mm. It sort of echoes, you know, it becomes an ideal even after the crusading movement is over. It's happening in Northern Europe. Why isn't Estonia pagan anymore? The answer is because there were crusades in the north of Europe. You know, the Middle East very much remembers them. Batman, one of his nicknames is the Caped Crusader. Yes. Exactly. And after 9/11, just once, George W. Bush managed to refer to the Crusades, and his advisor said, please don't do that again. The Middle East will not like that.
But then again, IQC, 40th anniversary D-Day, he said, his address to the forces said that you are on a crusade. That was the way he looked at it. And just before I let that one go, because I have to drop this in because certain people will be cheering. The Teutonic Knights, Estonia, the Baltics, people getting roasted alive in their armor. That one goes on forever. I mean, it's just, yes, let's go and have a crack at the
longest period. I mean, this is the thing. People think about, as you quite rightly said, you know, the clashing in the Middle East. When people think crusades, as you said, it's desert in the background. It is Saracens, in inverted commas, wielding their scimitars and the guys with the George Cross on them.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was part of it, but that was certainly not all of it. And again, going back to the previous time I was on, really one of the key, people think that it was Muslims and Christians in the Middle East, but actually one of the other major players in the Middle East during the Crusades was the Mongols.
Yep.
They changed the power dynamic completely, but they're not remembered today because you've got very angry Christians and very angry Muslims who like to use this period of history, and the Mongols don't fit into it, so they just get forgotten, even though, believe me, if the year was, let's say, 1280, you would be very worried about the Mongol Empire.
Indeed, but in the same way that the people reimagine 1492 and the reconquest, quote-unquote, of Spain, yes, which is where I'm sat, and we'll come on to somebody in a minute about that, hopefully, it's not that black and white. History isn't like that. So, you know, with the caliphate, and there's I'm going to be Asabads in this as well, so hang on. It's not just Christian versus Moors in Spain. That everybody's making little alliances with each other now.
100%, yeah.
In terms of public speaking, getting a crowd going, Urban II, and he's in France, isn't he? He's not in the Vatican in Rome. He's in Clermont. And he gets outside and he does this absolute tub thumping speech, and everybody goes, "Arr, let's," you know, and they just go, "Yeah, we're off now." Quick thing about Crusades, it's not, you know, it isn't Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Well, it kind of is, but it's not, you know, men looking to the east with clear. I mean, it is Glastonbury, isn't it, basically? You've got what, 40,000, you know, 40,000, however, going off on a crusade? I mean, it's this huge, isn't it, train of everything going off.
Yeah, and actually, just to really back you up on that, the first group that go out east aren't even the military people. There's the People's Crusade led by Peter the Hermit. Oh, yes. As you just said, this is Glastonbury persona. And look, nobody knows the exact source of certain stories, but I think this is pretty strong. Peter the Hermit had a scroll given to him by the angels from God himself, basically proclaiming that he had a divine provenance to take people all the way, walking all the way from Europe to Jerusalem, and that God would protect them. And you're going, well, hang on, where's the evidence with the scroll? But here's the genius thing. If you can't see the scroll, you don't have the faith. And I am pretty sure that's the source of the emperor's new clothes thing.
Yeah.
However, funnily enough, the Seljuk Turks in Anatolia didn't get the memo about him having this scroll. And so when they arrived in Constantinople, obviously the Byzantine emperor went, I do not want this rabble of... And the thing is, to actually go on crusade was always fabulously expensive.
Yeah.
So this was a chance for the locals to get involved. Indeed, sorry about this, but when it came to the idea of we want to help God against the godless, this is one of the first examples in Europe of like, well, I can't go, I'm not a soldier, I can't go to the Middle East, but what can I do? I can burn down the local synagogue. And so this is one of the first pogroms against Jews in Europe. It didn't just happen in Germany, but it did happen in Germany.
It was Germany, other places. It is Germany they kick off, isn't it? On the way through.
It's the Rhineland's the first area, but it happens in France as well, and also places in England too. Yeah. But the point is the People's Crusade. This is just full of all the disenfranchised. It's sometimes called the Children's Crusade. Lots of children there, lots of women there. These are obviously, you know, completely unmartial peasants. They arrive in Constantinople. It's basically like an army of beggars. They just immediately get them across the Bosporus into Anatolia.
Yeah.
And the Seljuks just descend on them and annihilate them. Yeah. Probably most of them were sold into slavery because you make more money out of a slave than a corpse. But they just evaporate. However, Peter makes it back and he starts linking up with the real crusade. But I mean, that's just one example of the shockwave of public opinion. Let's use, you know, how many people have found it hard to unify the whole of Europe? The Pope did by saying, let's go and get Jerusalem for God. And the reason why it's called Deus Vult, as you said, Council of Clermont, this big speech, is allegedly, and I do make the point in the book, you know, we don't know actually what people chanted. In fact, we don't even know exactly what was said in the speech, but they allegedly, they started to chant Deus Vult, God wills it.
Now, you just, because this, the one of the reasons that I love the Crusades is a couple of things. One, you've hit on my new fave thing, which is Byzantine, right? Eastern, you know, this is Constantinople. You've got all that lot, and they play a part in it, and they get involved with the Crusade, the Fifth Crusade, I think it is. Then they didn't really want it, but thanks to the Venetians. And then you've got the Seljuk Turks. Now, if you don't know who the Seljuk Turks, and you know, so we've got the cost crashing. So you've got Byzantine saying, that way, please, keep going. You've got the Seljuk Turks going, we're waiting for you, don't worry about that. You've got the Fatimids, yeah, down there as well. You've got our old friends, the Hun, or everyone would recall that. I mean, it really is a cast of characters. You've got, and also at some point, the assassins turn up, the old man of the mountains turn up.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. So give us the background about who's actually there at the moment. Because it's, you know, I mean, I know this is, we're talking in a period of like 200 years here, give or take Crusader states, but who are the people who they're going to be coming through? So Seljuk Turks, who, what, where?
So again, I don't want to keep saying this, but going back to when we first spoke about the Devil's Horseman, my point is that there are these different, basically angry men on horses with composite bones.
Marvelous.
That had a habit of crashing into societies. You know, the Huns were the first ones. We're talking about the late Roman Empire. But actually, one of these groups never made it to Europe, and they are the Turks, the Seljuk Turks. So the important thing is, and again, going back to your sort of headline bit, there's no such thing as a Saracen. The Western Europeans tended to lump everybody together. They're all Muslim and they're all foreign, basically. So they get the name Turk or Saracen, but ethnically, the Turks were, if you think of the Turks looking more like Mongols, they certainly don't look like the Arab stock of the Middle East. And they've been there for about a generation. So this is the local, let's imagine your local Arab Syrian resenting the fact that these pagans had come in howling from the north, who got converted to Islam. They don't want these people here, but they're just as foreign to that Syrian as they are to the Christian Westerners who turn up. Now, it was equal opportunity racism. You know, you get Saracens if you're Christian, but according to the Muslims, everybody from the West were called Franks.
Yep.
Even if they weren't from France, but they were all just Franks.
Yep. Absolutely. Now, as well as that, we've got the Fatimids in Egypt. Now, you may be thinking, hey, yes. Egypt, why? Because Alexandria becomes a massive thing later on. Egypt is the breadbasket. Egypt is the financial powerhouse, if you want. If you get Egypt, you can finance an army like you wouldn't believe. And that's the Fatimids, isn't it?
It is, yes. But the remarkable thing about the First Crusade is it's pure blind luck. It arrives at the point where the Fatimids, which had been the controlling power in the area, are at their weakest.
Yeah.
So really, the Christians, through blind luck, are coming into a power vacuum. If they'd arrived, let's say, 20 years earlier, or if they'd arrived 20 years later, there would have been enough of a central Islamic authority to head them off at the pass. But because they're coming into areas of like little warring states, jumping forwards to the Third Crusade, we got Saladin. And again, that's remembered as this great clash between Islam and Christianity, which is true. But it is interesting to note that Saladin, this great sword of Islam, he spent more time fighting other Muslim powers than he ever did fighting Christians, showing that there's a political practicality to all of this. You know, politics comes before the religion is what's happening even in the era of the Crusades.
And they, so the Second Crusade goes in, and by sheer blind luck, because they're all fighting amongst each other, saying, "I don't like your headdress, brother," they take Jerusalem. And then.
Well, it's the First Crusade. First Crusade takes Jerusalem, yeah.
But also, they set up, and here's my favorite thing of all time, because here we go, the Crusader States. And, yes, from the top, ladies and gentlemen.
From the top. County of Edessa.
Principality of Antioch. County of Tripoli, and then the biggie,
the Kingdom of Jerusalem.
Hurrah! Huzzah! Etc. I told you we were anorexic, didn't I? So therefore, what's all this about? This is port cities, isn't it? Because you've got. Let's just go. Because the powerhouses of the are Damascus, Aleppo, and Cairo. Those are the big ones of the opposition, if you like. So, yes. So the Crusaders, or whatever you want to call them now, get Aleppo. They get Antioch. They get Acre. They get Tripoli. Not the one in Libya. The one in. Which is now in the Lebanon and whatever, they get these really important seaports, which means they can be reinforced. People can come over, and suddenly they've got these strips of land that they can sort of push outwards. And Europeans are coming over and founding because the land is great. There's opportunities. Go east, young men. And also, here we go again. The Templars are over. And, you know, if you're good morning to the KT listening in. But also, if you are Knights Templar, I the second son, you know, the spare or whatever, you're not going to get the castle of the old. What better than go off to fight? You get your old, you get everything sort of nullified if you do anything wrong because you're going to fight and die for power. Paradise, etc., Christian paradise, and it's a good opportunity to go out and use some of those martial skills, and the Templars and the Hospitallers go out and have a great time.
Absolutely. We need to talk about the military orders just before we picking up your point there. Yeah. Well, first of all, you mentioned all the ports.
Yeah.
The one of those Crusader states that was not a port was Edessa.
Yeah.
It's kind of in modern-day Armenia. And funnily enough, it was the first one to fall because it was very hard to get to, simple as that. And as you said, you can reinforce the coast much easier, but it led to this area of trade and this exchanging of ideas. You get improvement of castles in Europe because they pick up the architecture in the Middle East.
Yes.
I love the fact that Romans introduced Western Europe to the taste of pepper, but we then forgot about it, but it was reintroduced thanks to the Crusades, as was ice cream. And my favorite fact, it was actually an Islamic invention, the wheelbarrow, which was then brought to Europe. So, you know, you look at your local place and you think there can't be something more British than a wheelbarrow sitting there in your garden. No, Islamic invention brought to you via the Crusades.
However, woke can we get? How B&Q's gone woke, for goodness sake? This is not the Crusade I voted for, Jem.
It's cultural appropriation gone mad, I tell you, Giles. The military orders is one of the most fascinating things about the Crusades.
Yeah.
So if you, as you said, you know, second, third son, heir and a spare,
yeah.
got some spares. And so you might go and become a monk, in which case you live in a community, take a vow of poverty, and you pray for God and write out a lot of books. The military orders are exactly the same idea. You live in a community, take a vow of poverty, but rather than praying for God, you fight for God. So these are the best equipped, best trained heavy cavalry in the world.
Yep.
And what you've got with the Crusades is there's only two types of fight that happen. You either have sieges, and because of these, you get some of the best medieval architecture and fortifications ever.
Because they fight differently, the opponents. Rather than building a siege tower and trying to knock it down, which is the Westerns do, there's a thing called Arrow Storm, which is a name for a metal band that hasn't been done yet. What they will do, what the opponents will do, it's absolutely batter you with a rain of arrows. And whilst that's going on, they send engineers down to dig. And obviously, if you've got very thin castle walls like you have in the UK, boom, gone. So that's why places like the Crag de Chevalier, the most famous Templar, for example, fortress, has got like literally 18-foot thick walls.
Oh, and some of its foundation areas are 70 feet thick. Nobody's quite sure why they went that big, but that gives you... Yeah, Crag de Chevalier, literally Rock of the Knights in modern-day Syria, is the castle I want to see, and is widely considered a perfect concentric castle. It's one of the greatest monuments of like Christian impact in the Middle East, and just a great castle. But to give you an idea, I learned more about its layout by Lawrence of Arabia. Because he was surveying that area during World War One, And so it was used as a depot in World War One, as a defensive position. And, you know, during the civil war in Syria, you had, I've now forgotten their name, but it doesn't matter. But the bad guy, ISIS, ISIS literally were using it. So, I mean, if you are using a military structure from pre-gunpowder era in the age of like drone technology, and it still fundamentally works as a fortification, that tells you how well they built it.
Right. We've done the military orders. Let's talk tactics here, because it's really important, because you've got
heavy absolutely. So I said siege is the one thing, or the other option is a pitch battle.
Right.
And with the Islamic world, they use the light horse cavalry.
Have we got composite bows, Jim? Have we got composite bows?
Composite bows, and we got maneuverability. They're on mares. And the reason why they're light cavalry is they might have a helmet on, and that's about it. And they're resplendent, they're silks and things like that. With the West, you've got, at least to begin, this is one of the things you need to be aware of. I know you know, but just to your listeners, one of the big mistakes you see in movies is when somebody is wearing chain mail, it's just on them. And that's not how they did it. Particularly you see it on their heads and it looks awful. And it looks like, well, that's not going to give you protection. If you hit over the head, it's that metal's still going to bite into your skin, and the answer is they knew that. So they've got underneath it a gambeson, a padded woolen jacket, which if you think about a Syrian summer, you're wearing basically padded wool plus metal on top of that. It was very, very hot. So what it means is you're a heavy cavalry. If you can get your heavy cavalry to make contact with the light cavalry, it is a hot knife through butter. But if the light cavalry has room for maneuver, the heavy cavalry will never catch up. And in the meantime, they're being constantly peppered with arrow fire. And therefore, it was really about maneuver. If they could, probably the Islamic powers would win. If they couldn't, then probably the Crusaders would win. But the Crusaders always had a manpower issue. You had enough men to either man those castles, those very clever castles, or to have a battle.
Right.
But if you lost a critical battle, you wouldn't have the men to garrison all those places.
And this is where we come to Hattin, because Hattin is the big battle, right? Before we get to that, let's just do the one. Let's do just a quick one. Let's say a quick hello, because people will know this anyway. So it's Richard, Richard I. His bestie, used to be a bestie at the time, sharing. Let's not even go there together. Philip II of France and Frederick I of Germany. They go off. It's the big hitting crusade. They stop off in Richard stop off in Cyprus as well. In the meantime, Berengaria puts the guy in chains of gold because he won't put them in chains of iron, etc. They land. They do, Acre is a defensive battle that Richard wins by managing to keep his troops in order, God knows how. And then he sees Jerusalem, almost gets there. Philip I has a lover's tiff and goes home, basically. Philip II goes home. And so that's the legendary. But that's where the legend of Saladin is, if you like, made. However, Saladin's the biggest triumph's got to be Hattin. And this is where you get the, the crusading forces, and they try and do that old thing, and they're dehydrated and they're tired and there's fire around, which is our favorite thing from Flaming Camels, and they won't stand still and get hit by cavalry. Off you go, Jim.
Absolutely. So what's really interesting about that period is if you read the history, the frustrating thing is you've got less of everything, you Christians. Maybe you should all stick together, because if the Muslims can get their act together, they're going to wipe out. So what do the Christians do? Constantly have petty arguments about everything. And you literally get the argument that, we could go out and fight Saladin, but if we lose, we'll lose everything. And basically, the loudest people in the room win, with like, no, God's on our side. We'll definitely win this one, honestly. And as you said, Saladin just goaded them into this, but made really sure that everything was going to work his way. We are talking in the height of Assyrian summer here. And all the Crusaders, as I said, are wearing their wool. They need water. You need water for the horses, just pure and simple. And he made sure that all the wells were poisoned. All the sort of any kind of shrubs in the area were set on fire. And the chronicles just keep emphasizing how hot it was. But the point is, personally, at that point, it's like, he knows we're coming. He's thwarting our actions. I would have put the, it's like, okay, we tried, let's go home.
Yeah.
They keep going, and they meet, at the Horns of Hattie, basically these two mountains that kind of look like horns. And there's this like low valley that slowly goes upwards. And the Islamic forces are up the slope. So first of all, they've got to charge uphill, but
never
also there's
a good move.
Loads of room. There's loads of room. So what happens is the heavy cavalry charge straight at the center of the Islamic forces. Kind of makes sense. I guess they're there now. They've got to commit. All the Islamic forces do is open a gap. The heavy cavalry go straight through, causing no damage. Now they're surrounded, picked off by the archers, and it's all done in a day. And then after that point, I mean, there's this wonderful scene at the end where the King of Jerusalem's actually captured, and Saladin gives him a drink, showing that he shows that he is his guest and therefore he's safe. However, next to him is Raynaud de Châtillon,
who's
one of the great psychopaths of history.
Absolutely.
He'd actually killed Saladin's sister in a raid. He was just a terrible human being. He was terrible to Christians as well as Muslims. And he was
an equal opportunity psychopath, wasn't he, basically?
Yeah, equal opportunity psycho. At one point, he got angry with a bishop in Antioch and had him covered in honey and put on the roof of his church in the baking sun. Nice guy. Yeah. And he takes the cup from the King of Jerusalem to sort of like drink it because he's parched. And Saladin just knocks it out of his hand, takes him outside and chops his head off. And it's like, and absolutely that was the right thing to do to that guy. But it's one of these things where there's the movie Kingdom of Heaven.
Yeah.
It gets almost everything wrong. It looks like they're going to do the Battle of Hattin, but they just cut to the end of it. And it's like, okay, that's clever. That is very clever in terms of a movie, but it's one of the most cinematic, it could have been a great moment in cinema history. We don't get to see it. Sorry about that.
Just the, because we've got 3 minutes, boom. We've gone through that like the Frankish charge. We didn't even get to the mounted camels or the Fatimids, but the enduring legacy of this, because the Crusader States, it's a 200-year period, the Crusader States. And think about that. So that's basically 1825 to now, okay? And the amalgamation of cultures. I mean, there's a big thing about the, you know, the Franks now become, more too Easternized than the whole city. They're wearing pointy shoes. They're speaking the local language. But it is that, again, that mezcla, that whole mix of communities. And I'm sitting down here in southern Spain, Al-Andalus, etc., so we know a bit about that. We didn't even get onto the Black Douglas. But anyway, Siege of Tebar, we'll talk about that some other time. But it is this amazing amalgamation. Templars are at the high point. They've got massive finances. You could say that international banking starts through the Templars at this point.
I mean,
there's so much that gets taken back and forth. Science, medicine, astrology, you name it, and it really is quite something that is airbrushed over in history.
Absolutely. So the thing I love is the fact that, as I said, some people are literally walking from London to Jerusalem. That is a very long, dangerous way. Eventually people work out they can go by boats, but anyway.
Yeah.
Just as an example, Second Crusade was pretty much a disaster, but one of the things is the English Crusaders on the way to the Second Crusade join in part of this sort of fighting in the Iberian Peninsula, and they're the ones who help capture Lisbon.
Yep.
So, the capital of Portugal was made the capital of Portugal via the Second Crusade, something that happens still to this day. But, as you said, the Westerners turn up in the East and they find it's kind of like everyone's gone native, but it takes, are you going to carry your money all the way across Europe and on into Asia? So what the Templars do is they come up with this area where you give the local temple, your Templars' location, your money, and they give you a little writ saying, you've given me 10 pounds of silver. And then when you go to the Middle East, you give them that writ, and then they give you back real 10 pounds of silver. So they've invented the check. The check, which was used into the 21st century, was originally created as a way to carry your wealth during the Crusades.
Absolutely amazing stuff. And we didn't get onto this Vikings thrashing around there as well. Everybody gets involved. We didn't even get to the sacking of Constantinople by Venetians.
No,
they just got bored.
No, it's the Fourth Crusade.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to run out of time completely. What do you think the lasting legacy, though, is about Crusades? I mean, the reason you wrote this book was for people to get an idea, right? You've got 59 seconds. Off you go, Jem.
Well, what I find interesting is even in the First Crusade, where there are massacres and battles between the two sides, what's interesting is there's a lot more talking between the two sides than you would initially think. And there were lots of times when the Crusaders turned up at a city and the Islamic leader went, okay, fine, I'm on your side now.
Yep.
So if we can talk like that then, I think we need to do a better job of it today.
You know how people said the first time you were like my manic twin? Well, I think we've not only got chain-mailed anoraks out, we've got the full nine yards. We didn't even get onto the thing about the Islamic mace and the fact that mitres and they're beating people rather than sword. They haven't got scissors because they can't get through chainmail, so you hit them with something really heavy and send shockwaves through the body. Perhaps just before Christmas, I think that'll be the perfect Christmas present. If people want to follow you online, which I think they should do, where should they find you, Jem? 10 seconds.
I'm at Jem Dadutu on Blue Sky, Twitter, Threads, and I've got a podcast called Condensed Histories. Available everywhere.
Marvellous, right.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.